This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for being here today, and happy Mother's Day to all of you. So my name is Mona West. I'm the director of the Adult Formation Program here at St. David's. And just to remind you that the second Sunday of every month, we try to have what we call a holy conversation. And of course, this is the second Sunday of the month, and we are having a holy conversation with Layla King, and I'll say more about Reverend King here in just a moment. In terms of hearing her story about being a Palestinian Christian, an Episcopal priest. So what we try to do in these holy conversations is to engage a current topic or issue from the perspective of our faith, and to do that in a welcoming and hospitable way and a prayerful way. And so this is our monthly installment of Holy Conversation. So let's see here. So let me tell you a little bit about the Reverend Canon Layla King. She's a Palestinian American Episcopal priest and a writer. She's an advocate of small churches. She's a wife and a mother, and I'm glad to welcome her family back. Her husband, Dr. Ben King, who teaches church history at the Seminary of the Southwest, was a speaker for us several months ago, and they brought their children and Layla's mom, and so they're all back. So she's a wife and a mother. She's a founding member of both Palestinian Anglicans and Clergy Allies and the Small Churches Big Impact Collective, and those both have websites. Currently, she serves as the canon for mission in small congregations for the Episcopal Diocese of West Texas. She writes about her experiences as a Palestinian, a clergywoman, and a mother at thankfulpriest.com. And her first book, A Generational Memoir, will be released in the spring of 2025. So, Layla, we're just very glad that you're with us today. So I'm going to let you take it away. Just to remind you, there will be some time for some questions and conversation as we come up on the 11 o'clock hour. And if you have questions or comments, if you could come to this microphone, this helps the people on Zoom. We've got about 15 people on Zoom this morning. And so they're able to hear your questions if you come to this microphone. So, Reverend King.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here with you all. Is that too loud? No, that's okay. I'm so glad to be. Whenever I'm wearing a microphone, I'm so used to small churches that never have microphones. So I'm used to using my preaching voice, if you get my drift. And so when I have a mic, I have to figure out how to temper that. So thank you all for this invitation to be with you and to invite me into these holy conversations with you. I am so pleased to be back at St. David's, having come here as the spouse the first time around to be the speaker this time around is a real pleasure. There are some seats up in the front. I know it's very un-Episcopalian, but there are some seats up in the front, and Mona has been good enough to print out some handouts that I will direct your attention to that we'll be using as we go along. So I want to start us off with a very short video clip. You're going to see some pictures, but mostly I want you to hear my grandmother's voice. In the summer of 2002, I was a very recently graduated college student, looking forward to a career in teaching at the time. But I had a summer where I spent every day of the week with my grandmother for about 6 or 8 weeks, listening to her stories and recording them. If you can like cast your mind back all the way about 20 years, it was one of those mini cassette players. Do y'all know what I'm talking about? You had to like press record on it, right? You had to actually rewind and fast forward if you wanted to listen to anything over again. So I spent a summer listening to my grandmother's story, my Palestinian grandmother's stories, and recording them on that little mini tape recorder. And then one of the librarians at the University of the South in the School of Theology happily and gratefully digitized those recordings for me. So I want to play this is the very start, like the first time I pressed record on that mini cassette player, and you're going to hear a much younger me and my grandmother, may she rest in peace, And I just want you to hear her voice and her laughter. So that's where we're going to start today. Oh, we can't hear it. Sorry. I'm sure the people on Zoom can hear it, but I don't think we can hear it here. It's playing now. Can you hear anything? No. Well, you know what? We'll skip that. It's not all that important. So we'll skip that. It's always just nice to hear her voice. I love to invoke her laughter, particularly, which is what starts this audio off. But this, you can see a picture of this is my grandmother Bahi, my mom May, who's also with us in person, and me at the event of my ordination to the diaconate. So that is them. And I will stop this screen share so that folks on Zoom can see. So you hopefully have either with you or you can share a quiz. I know it's always exciting. Some of you may not have been students for a very long time, but a quiz is always fun, right? I mean, Amy is a student, I know, so this is just like extra special for her. She just gets another quiz. So I'm gonna use this quiz to sort of frame the stories that I'm gonna tell you. And these again are stories that are handed down to me from my grandmother all those many years ago. So if you get 100, you get straight to heaven. So, but if you don't, you know, I can't make any promises. But here we go. So no pressure or anything, but here we go. So number one, the term Semitic refers to ethnic Jews, ethnic Arabs, all of the above or none of the above? All of the above, right? You're starting out well. Well done. So it refers to all of the above, both ethnic Jews and ethnic Arabs. So this is a dictionary definition of the word Semitic. Relating to or denoting a family of languages that includes Hebrew, Arabic, and Aramaic, and certain ancient languages, such as Phoenician and Akkadian, and relating to the peoples who speak Semitic languages, especially Hebrew and Arabic. So Palestinians, Arabs who speak Arabic, are also a Semitic people, just like Jews. And I think that's really important because what's the term that gets thrown around a lot these days? Anti-Semitic. You're being anti-Semitic. If you criticize Israel, if you say anything that someone takes as somehow criticism of Jewish people, you're called anti-Semitic, right? But we have to, and it's just gotten to the point where we understand the term anti-Semitic to mean anti-Jewish. Which is okay. I'm okay with that. I mean, I don't love that fact as a Palestinian, but I'm okay with that. At the same time, I want us to all be aware that the Semitic people include Arabs, include Palestinians, include me, include my mother, include my grandmother, right? And I want to tell you a couple of stories about that. So I'm Palestinian American. I'm ordained Episcopal priest. My family have been Anglicans for generations upon generations upon generations, further back than we can count or that we know. When I was growing up, I grew up at outside of Houston, actually. It's now very much inside of Houston, but then it was just on the outside of Houston. And I worshiped at St. Dunstan's Episcopal Church with my grandparents and my mother and my sister and many of my a number of my great aunts and my great uncle. In fact, my grandmother was one of 9 siblings, 7 of those siblings. So my grandmother, 5 of her sisters and her brother lived within about a 15-minute radius of our house in Houston. And about a third of us were Episcopalian, a third were Baptist. It's okay, let them be that way. And a third were Catholic. And so we would all go to our various church services on Sunday morning. And then afterwards, we would all congregate at one of my great aunt's houses in Houston. And for what we called coffee, but it was not like a coffee hour. It was an entire spread that great aunt had been working on all week of Arabic food and hummus and baba ganoush and hard-boiled eggs. I always remember the hard-boiled eggs for whatever reason. And coffee and all of it. And one of my favorite memories is the fact that my great uncle, the only boy in the family, would always, whatever great aunt's house we were at, he would always sit at the head of the table, and he would take the warm pita bread that was always available in baskets in every room of the house. And he would take the pita bread and he would break it in half, and he would keep one half, and he would pass the next half to whoever was sitting next to him. And it was only until I was really ordained that I recognized that I got every Sunday of my childhood, I got two communions. Every Sunday of my childhood, I got two communions. And that was so intrinsic to my understanding of faith and of how we share in what is holy with one another, right? Why am I telling you all this? Because I want us to remember that Palestinian Christians exist, right? We are here and we are part of our church, and we have always been part of the church. And that's, I think we lose sight of that so much in this day and age, okay? Another thing I like to remind people is, again, going back to this idea that Jews and Arabs are of the same stock. We are the same Semitic people. There's really very little difference between us. And remember that Jesus was a Jew himself. He was a Jew from the Galilee, right? He was a Jew in what is today Palestine. So Jesus is not only my ancestor of faith, but Jesus is also my like actual literal ancestor as a Palestinian, right? And my favorite story about this is that a couple of years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I don't know if you remember this, there was a sort of AI generated image of what Jesus would have looked like. Do you all remember this? And I didn't know that it was going around social media at the time. All I know is I was scrolling Facebook one day, and I'm scrolling Facebook, and I sort of passed this picture of my cousin Joseph, my uncle's son. And he looks sort of funny in the picture, but I'm just scrolling, right? So I just think, oh, that's a funny picture of Joseph. Why does he look that way? And I keep scrolling. Then a few minutes later, I scroll past another picture of my cousin Joseph. And I was like, what? Why is my cousin Joseph like all over my Facebook today? Why is he posting this funny picture of himself? And I keep scrolling, and I see another picture of my cousin Joseph. And so I stop and I look at who is assuming it's my cousin Joseph posting this picture of himself. And it's not. It's one of my clergy colleagues who has no idea who my cousin Joseph is. And I was like, why is my clergy colleague posting this picture of my cousin Joseph? And that was when I first read the description and realized it was the AI generated photo of Jesus. But it looked, I kid you not, it looked exactly like my cousin Joseph, who's like a 20, you know, late 20s, in his late 20s at the time. So again, it's just this reminder that Palestinian Christians are the inheritors of both in terms of our faith and in terms of our genetics, of our DNA, of who Jesus was and who Jesus is to us today. All right, you did great on the first question. Are you going to continue to do as great? Number two, before 1948, the land that is now called Israel and the occupied territories was governed by the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire, all of the above, or none of the above. Oh, we're getting some differences here. So it's actually C. It's all of the above, right? Not simultaneously. So that was a bit of a trick question. Not simultaneously. But in the years leading up to 1948, originally it was governed by the Ottoman Empire. And then after the First World War, it changed hands because the Ottomans lost. And it became a British mandate. So the story I want to tell you about this, and if you want to see a map, if you look at the second handout you have, this first map on the left is what we're talking about when we're talking about British Mandate Palestine. This would have been the sort of political boundaries of British Mandate Palestine. So my great-great-grandmother was a woman named Zaleh. Anyone have any Arabic any Arabic linguistics behind them? Okay, no. I always like to put anyone with Arabic language on the spot, but no one to do that today. So the word zale in Arabic means upset or sorrow. So my great-great-grandmother was called Sorrow. That was her name. She was called Zale, and that's because she came from actually came from a Catholic family in a small village called Shefa'amr, about 12 miles outside of Haifa. And she was a girl. She was born a girl when the family really wanted a boy. So they named her Sarah, Zale. But actually that name, it shows you how these things are important, right? That name sort of, I think, really defined a lot of her life. So Zale married my great-great-grandfather, a man named Amin, and he was Anglican. He was one of four brothers. Three of those brothers lived in a house together. They were merchants, and their shop was on the ground floor, and then their living quarters were above them. And so Zale married into this family of Anglican merchants. She was the only Catholic of the wives. The other wives were all Anglican, and the Anglican women were more well-educated. Anglicans tended to put more stock in educating their women than the Catholics did. And so Zale was really, she was illiterate, and she was really looked down upon by the other wives and by the other brothers, Amin's brothers in the family. But she did have two children, Anis and Anissa. Anissa was the girl, the daughter, and she was older, and then Anis, the boy. And when her children were still quite young, World War I started. And if you remember, the region of Palestine is under Ottoman control, and the Ottomans drafted every able-bodied man they could. And so Amin and one of his brothers were drafted early on in the war and sent to the front lines and killed almost instantaneously. When they got news of that back in the household, the one remaining brother who was still living there and his wife and his sister-in-law, they kicked Zale out of the house. That's a very emotive response. I appreciate that. Yeah, they kicked Zale out of the house and they kept her children with her. And she was sent back to her family. She eventually married. She had two more children, one of whom died of, what is it? Is it typhoid fever? Died of typhoid fever. And she lived the rest of her life as sort of this very sorrowful woman. So just a reminder that, you know, be careful what you name your children. It's very important. But when the Ottomans lost World War I, they were on the losing side of World War I, again, the region changed hands and became a British mandate. And for the Palestinians, for the folks living in Palestine, having British rule actually was a step up. It was a definite step up from the Ottoman Empire, which I want to point out because, you know, the British mandate was an obvious example of colonialism. We don't like colonialism. Colonialism is bad, generally speaking. But I think it's important to remember that there were some benefits, right? Nothing is totally evil. Nothing is totally good. And for the Palestinians who were living in Palestine at this time, the British came in and they brought education, they brought wealth, they brought technology, maternal and infant mortality dropped significantly, right? People became much more well-educated. And my grandmother would say that when the British came, they thought that they were angels. They really thought that they were like a salvation because all of the images that they used to have that came from the West were of angels always white. And evil people, you know, like the devil was always darker skinned. And so when these British came with all their whiteness, the Palestinians really thought, oh, these are our salvation. And in a lot of, it was bad. It's not great. Colonialism is not a good thing. But in a lot of ways, the Brits brought some very good things to the people of Palestine. And again, nothing is clear cut here. There's always nuance, and I think it's really important that we remember that. Okay. Any questions so far? Like about where I'm hoping to leave a little bit of time for questions at the end, but if there's anything that is particularly unclear, just throw your hand up and let me know. All right, number three, let's see how we do. In the first half of the 20th century, the Arabs who lived in the region called Palestine practiced Islam, Christianity, Judaism, all of the above, none of the above. All of the above. Okay, we're getting back on track. That's good. Yes. Both in Shefa Amr, where my great-great-grandmother, my great-great-grandparents lived, and in Haifa, where my grandmother eventually moved with her family. In both places where my grandmother grew up, there were neighborhoods of particular faiths, right? So there would be an area of Shefa Amr, say, or of Haifa that was predominantly Muslim, an area that was predominantly Christian, an area that was predominantly Jewish. And there were some other faiths as well that were represented, you know, the Druze, the Catholic Maronites, like my great-great-grandmother was, right? So there were some various, the Protestants, the Anglicans. So there were neighborhoods that were sort of distinct, but all of these people lived as one community together. And they related, I mean, it's a tiny village in the middle of Palestine, right? So these people are not living separate lives from one another. They're not in tension with one another. Is it always a happy family, right? Is it always paradise? No, of course not. Just like you probably don't like your neighbors every once in a while, right? But for the most part, everyone lived together in community together, and they functioned together as a society. They would participate in each other's religious festivals and personal events. So when the Jews celebrated Passover, everyone was invited to that celebration. When the Christians celebrated Easter, everyone participated in some way in that celebration because it was a community together. When someone got married, whether it be a Muslim person or a Jewish couple or a Christian couple, the entire community came and celebrated that event together. And they celebrated it in similar ways, even though they were of different faiths. So for example, the Palestinian Debki, the dance, the Debki dance, which is a celebratory dance, would be danced at every wedding. Didn't matter what the faith was, because it is a cultural event. Right? The women would all say blessings and then do their lulus. Right? That happened at every wedding. Didn't matter whether it was a Muslim or a Christian or a Jewish wedding, right? Because they share the same culture. They are the same people, regardless of their religion. Why am I telling you this? Because what do we hear about the conflict today? Why is there a conflict in the Middle East today? Because they're of different religions, right? Because the people there are of different religions. It's the Jews against the Muslims. That is a lie. That is a lie. It is not a religious conflict. The conflict that is happening in the Middle East right now is not a religious conflict. It is a political one. Okay, moving on to number four. Zionist refers to someone who subscribes or subscribed to a political movement originating in the 19th and 20th century Britain that advocated for a homeland for European Jews in the region then known as Palestine. European Jewish militiamen who used terrorism to forcibly evict Arabs from their homes in Palestine in the years immediately before and after 1948. The belief that it is the right of Israel to maintain current and build more settlements in Palestinian territories illegally occupied by Israel, all of the above or none of the above. All of the, you guys are noticing a pattern, I bet, right? It is all of the above. And I want to dwell on this one just a little bit longer, although I'm aware of the time, because the tagline for Zionism, when it first originated in the 19th century, the tagline for Zionism as a Western political movement was a land without a people for a people without a land. That was the tagline of Zionism. A land without a people, meaning this land in Palestine, didn't have anyone in it. And a people, so the Jews, the European Jews who had been traumatized by not just the Holocaust, which would come in the 20th century, but even before then had been severely persecuted throughout Europe, right? So this people, these European Jews, were a people without a land. And so we're going to give them this land that is Palestine without a people. What's wrong with that? There were people there, right? My great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother Zale was there. My great-grandmother Anissa was there. My grandmother Bahi was there. Their families were there. There were millions of Palestinians living in Palestine. That tagline of Zionism, for a land without a people, for a people without a land, that is also a lie. It is a lie, right? So what I want to tell you about this story, if you look at your second map on your map page, you'll see Palestine on the first map became Israel on the second map. And that happened in May of 1948. And in January of 1948, my grandparents were married, January 3rd, 1948. They met at St. John's Episcopal Church in Haifa, where they had grown up together, and they sang in the choir together. And they were married on January 3rd, 1948. They took a short honeymoon to Cairo for about 10 days, during which time my grandmother got pregnant with my mother. So that just gives you my mother's age. So just hold on to that fact for a minute. So they were married January 3rd, 1948. They went to Cairo on honeymoon. They came back, and they were put in a quarantine when they came back, not because of illness, but because already by that time, Palestine was a tinderbox. There was already a lot of violence that was happening between these European Jewish militiamen, these militias that were formed of European, imported European Jews, and the native population of Palestinians and the revolutionaries who were against the importation of these European Jews and the stealing of their land. And so what happened, because the European Jews, the militias, had the backing of the British government, they were allowed to do whatever they wanted, basically. So the European Jewish shops were well stocked. Any Palestinian shops, any Palestinian merchants, they couldn't get the goods that they needed, right? So their livelihoods were at stake. My grandmother couldn't get the material, couldn't get a wedding dress from a shop, because if she went to a European Jewish shop, if her family went to a European Jewish shop, then they would be killed by the revolutionaries, because you can't go to one of those shops, right? You can't betray your own people. But the Palestinian shops were either closed or they didn't have the stock. So my grandmother was able to get the material, and then they had a seamstress come and live at the house for a week while she made my grandmother's dress, because it was too dangerous for the woman, the seamstress, to go back and forth between homes, because it was too crazy. And people were just taken off the street. They were just killed for no reason, right? In the evenings, the Jewish militias would roll barrels of explosives into the Christian and Muslim neighborhoods in the middle of the night. And they would just explode in the middle of the night, right? So this was the kind of the kind of context that my grandmother came back to when they came back from Cairo. They were put in a quarantine because the British mandate, the British government, had set up a curfew, and the curfew would last for days. Nobody was allowed out of their home for any reason for days on end. And when they came home from Cairo, there was one of these curfews on. So eventually my grandfather had a brother who knew someone in the fire department, and they sent a fire truck to get them from the quarantine and take them finally home. So this was the sort of context that my grandmother's newlywed life started out in. And by April of 1948, there was such intense fear all around them that my grandparents decided they had to flee. They were in fear of their life. My grandfather would leave my grandmother at home and try and go to work every day. And my grandmother was the only person left in their entire apartment building because everyone else had fled by that time. So in April of 1948, my grandmother was 4 months pregnant with my mother. They left almost everything that they had at home and they boarded a cargo ship. They had one suitcase between them and my grandmother had a purse with all of her jewelry and what cash they could carry. They boarded a cargo ship from the port in Haifa, and they spent 2 nights and 1 day on this cargo ship fleeing for their lives to Beirut. My grandmother said she doesn't know how she kept the baby, that she was so nauseous and so sick, both with seasickness and with pregnancy hormones, and she was so scared for her life that she remains surprised her entire life that she held on to that baby in her womb. That was my mother. So I wish I could say that that happened in 1948 and it was terrible because it was, but that it stopped and that that doesn't happen anymore today. But of course we know that that's wrong. Right? That kind of persecution of Palestinians happens today, very much so, as we can see if we just look at the news. With all, except now it has all the additional force and power of state-run violence, which is what is happening when we see Israel bomb Gaza, when we see Israel kill civilians, starve children, right? And it's not just in Gaza, it's in the West Bank too. It's in Jerusalem as well. To this day, Israel continues this state-run violence against Palestinians of all varieties, right? Christians and Muslims. There will be hope in here somewhere, I promise. It does get better. Okay, number five, Israeli settlements in the West Bank today are illegal. Are equipped with utilities, services, and infrastructure, are peopled by Israeli Jews and protected by Israeli defense forces, both of whom regularly demean, belittle, and attack Palestinians in surrounding areas, all of the above or none of the above?
Oh.
All of the above, you're right. If you look at your third and fourth maps, I'm not gonna go into detail on them, but you can just see, you can see what it looks like if you are a Palestinian living in occupied territories today. And I particularly want to point your attention to the second map on the back page, because when I first looked at this map, I thought, oh, okay, all the blue stuff is where Palestinians are and all the orange is where Israeli is, but it's actually opposite, right? This is meant to be Palestinian land. This is meant to be Palestinian land, and it is a majority of these Israeli settlements. It is meant to be Palestinian land, and it is a majority of Israeli settlements, okay? And when I say it's a majority of Israeli settlements, you know, it's not like the Israelis are living in these areas and, you know, but Palestinians just sort of move freely among them. No, right? Palestinians are very much kept under lock and key, right? Their freedom of movement is non-existent, and there's no other word for it but to say persecution. Palestinians are persecuted by the Israeli settlers and by the Israeli Defense Force. They are marked out for being Palestinian and demeaned and belittled and violated, and violence is used against them on a regular basis. And it's all fine, right? These people are not punished. The Israeli Defense Force, the Israeli settlers who do this, they're not punished. They're just allowed to do it. They're allowed to kill, they're allowed to violate, and it just goes unnoticed, okay? So Palestinians are the victims of constant attacks in their own land, in what is meant to be their own land. I'm moving a little bit quickly through this because I'm just aware of the time. So, and I don't want to make anyone late for church. So, you know. So moving on, Christians in Palestine today exist, have existed in Palestine since the time of Pentecost, live in Gaza, the West Bank, Jerusalem, and Israel proper, are victims of Israeli discrimination and targeted violence, all of the above or none of the above? All of the above, right? So I want to read to you portion of the Acts of the Apostles, which you're going to hear again next Sunday, because next Sunday is Pentecost. I don't know if that snuck up on you the way it snuck up on me. So this is Acts 2, chapter 2, verses 5 through 11. Now there were devout Jews from every nation under heaven living in Jerusalem. And at this sound, the sound of the wind, the crowd gathered and was bewildered because each one heard them speaking in the native language of each. Amazed and astonished, they asked, "Are not all these who are speaking Galileans? And how is it that we hear, each of us, in our own native language, Parthians, Medes, Elamites, and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya belonging to Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs? In our own languages, we hear them speaking about God's deeds of power." Now, I gave you a little hint in the way I read that, but what did you notice out of that reading? Arabs, right? You heard Arabs, right? So Arabs were among the first Christians. They were among the first, and these are Jewish Arabs, right? Because they're in Jerusalem for the celebration of the Jewish feast, right? So these are Jewish Arabs, but I want you to notice something else. If we go all the way back to the beginning of what the crowds say, are not all these who are speaking, so all the disciples, right, who are speaking in tongues, the first followers of Jesus, are not all these who are speaking Galileans? The first disciples of Jesus were all Galileans. Where is Galilee? Palestine. Galilee is in Palestine, right? The Jewish disciples of Jesus, the first Jewish disciples of Jesus were Galileans. In today's world, we would call them Palestinian Jews. They are Palestinians, right? And if we think of them as the first Christians, as the first followers of Christ, then they are Palestinian Christians, right? The first followers of Jesus were Palestinian Jewish Christians. That's who they are. That's who they were. And so when we talk about Palestinian Christians who exist in Palestine today, we are talking about the faith and genetic inheritors of these people, of the very first disciples of Christ. I don't have a ton of stories because my grandparents fled in 1948, remember? So I don't have a lot of stories of that are personal to me of the Palestinian Christian experience of Israeli apartheid and Israeli violence. But those stories are out there and they're very easy to find. The first place that I always send people is a document called Kairos Palestine, Kairos, K-A-I-R-O-S. And if you just Google it, you'll find it. Kairos Palestine. Has anyone heard of this document? No. So it was a document written in 2009 by all the patriarchs, and they're all men. It's still in the Middle East. So all the patriarchs of all the Christian churches in Israel. So the Anglicans, the Lutherans, the Catholics, the Eastern Orthodox, all of them. And it is their experience of being Palestinian Christians in Israel. And I really, really, really recommend and highly encourage you to read it. Maybe Mona can organize a study. The Presbyterians have done an excellent job. They put together a very free study guide of the Kairos Palestine document. So I encourage you to look that up and read it and hear the stories of Palestinian Christians who are living there today, although it was in 2009, so we've moved on a little bit since then. Okay, we're moving on to number 7. The current nation state of Israel is a modern day continuation of the ancient Israel, which we read about in the Old Testament. The beginnings of the fulfillment of prophecies made in the biblical book of Revelation. The Israel to which we refer in the Book of Common Prayer, and I give you an example there. I think that's from Eucharistic Prayer B, where we give thanks to God for the calling of Israel to be your people. All of the above or none of the above? No, you all are good. Y'all are good. I was trying to trick you there, but I didn't. So it is actually none of the above, right? None of the above. So the current nation state of Israel is called Israel on purpose, right? The people who made Israel are aware of the Hebrew scriptures. Obviously, they're Jews, right? So it is called Israel on purpose, but there is no relationship between the modern day state of Israel and the ancient Israel we read about in the Bible. There is no relationship between the modern day state of Israel and the Israel that the ancient Israel that we read about in the Bible. In fact, there is a whole sort of movement, a whole doctrine of belief that is based on that lie, on the lie that there is some sort of relationship between modern day Israel and ancient Israel. And it comes out of a Christian belief, and it's called Christian Zionism. Christian Zionism is sort of the belief, if you look at that question seven, and A and B, right? That this sort of belief that the modern day state of Israel is a continuation of ancient Israel, and that the prophecies in Revelation are about the current state of Israel, right? That none of that is true, but it is a sort of effect of this idea of Christian Zionism, that there are Christians out there who believe that somehow if we can get all the Jews back into Israel, that then Christ will come again, right? Which is a false belief. But I also want to point out that there's more to it than just that, which we, you know, enlightened as Episcopalians, we might think, oh, well, we know better than that. We know that that's not the case. But there is Christian Zionism that's really sort of embedded in our systems, because we tend to not question that there is some sort of relationship between modern day Israel and ancient Israel. And so we think, if you've ever thought to yourself, well, Jews have some sort of right to that land there. Where does that idea come from, that Jews have a right to the land there? That idea comes from a belief that the Judeo-Christian scriptures, that the Bible has some sort of right to dictate modern politics. And if you think about that, we don't think that as Episcopalians. We don't think about that about anything else, right? We know that there is a sort of separation between personal belief and global politics. It's only when we get to this issue that we get caught up in this sort of insidious Christian Zionism that is part of who we are and how we believe in the world around us. And so we really have to be careful about why we think that anyone has any particular right to any particular land, right? Except for the people who are indigenous to that land. Okay, we're going to move on from there because I am aware of the time. Number eight, anyone who speaks up for Palestinians and calls for a free Palestine today must be Muslim, is a terrorist and/or a terrorist supporter, is anti-Semitic, meaning anti-Jewish, because we know Semitism, we know what that means now, but meaning anti-Jewish, wants the eradication of Israel, all of the above or none of the above? None of the above, right? We've started a new pattern here. Well done. Good job. So raise your hand if you think I'm Muslim, a terrorist, or a terrorist supporter. Good, thank you. I'm none of those things. I do happen to be Palestinian, but otherwise I'm just like you. I'm an Episcopalian just like you. My family is Episcopalian just like you, right? So I am none of these things. I am neither Muslim, I'm not a terrorist, I'm not a terrorist supporter. Now, perhaps you think just because of maybe what you came into this room with, maybe because of some of the things I've said, perhaps you do think I am anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish in this way. Perhaps you think I do want the eradication of Israel, because a lot of what we hear in the media these days might make you think that anyone who criticizes Israel, anyone who has a different sort of story to tell, is anti-Jewish or does want the eradication of Israel. But I'm here to tell you that that's not true. I'm not anti-Jewish. I do not want the eradication of Israel. I think Israel is here to stay. I think it's unfair and it's deeply unjust that my family had to be evicted from their home so violently in order for Israel to exist. So that, like, that doesn't, to say that I'm okay with Israel existing, to say that I think that Israel is a reality and Israel is not going anywhere and shouldn't go anywhere, doesn't make it okay that that happened to my family. But Israel is here to stay. Israel is a reality. There are people, there are Israelis now who live in Israel, and to force them out of their homes, right? That would do no good. So I'm not for the eradication of Israel. I think Israel is here to stay, and I think people who live in Israel today have a right to remain there. But I also think that the people who were evicted also have a right to that land, right? So I am not anti-Jewish. I do not want the eradication of Israel. But here's what I do want. I want the ability to tell my story, my ancestors' stories, my grandparents' stories, my mother's story. I want the ability to tell my story without being labeled anti-Semitic. I want a global political recognition of the real underlying issues of the conflict in the Holy Land being located in British imperialism and violent Zionism in the decades leading up to and the crisis created by the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948, so that we can find a political solution to the crisis that's happening right now and that continues to unfold before our eyes with such particular violence and harm against innocent Palestinians. I want a political solution to a political problem that gives Palestinians voice, dignity, and equality. I want the ability to tell my story without being labeled anti-Semitic. I want a global political recognition of the real underlying issues of the conflict. And I want a political solution to the crisis that gives Palestinians voice, dignity, and equality. That's all I want. Number 9, the following people were supporters of Palestinian rights: Nelson Mandela, Malcolm X, Albert Einstein, Mahatma Gandhi, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, all of the above or none of the above? All of the above. I switched it up on you again, but you were not to be caught. Well done. I don't have any particular stories here to tell, but it is true that all these people were supporters of Palestinian rights. And I just think it's helpful to note how different their backgrounds are, right? We're talking about white people, black people, people of color, everything in between, right? We're talking about people of very different faiths, very different backgrounds. And I always like to point out Archbishop Desmond Tutu, because, you know, he's one of ours. He's an Anglican hero. And he's someone who knew a thing or two about apartheid. And it's important to point out that Archbishop Desmond Tutu, before his death, called the system of oppression in Israel against Palestinians apartheid himself. And number 10, so that we can finish on time for church and hopefully have a little time for questions: the Episcopal Church was among the first churches in the West to condemn the slaughter of innocent civilians in Palestine in the weeks after October 7th and to call for a ceasefire. Like Pope Francis, has called Israel's recent actions in Palestine terrorism, has taken effective steps to educate our members about our Palestinian siblings in the Holy Land, both in recent weeks and throughout the past decades. All of the above or none of the above? None of the above. None of the above. Yeah. As a Palestinian Episcopal clergywoman, let me tell you how much that hurts. It hurts. It hurts a lot. I've been Episcopalian since I was baptized as an infant, right? It hurts a lot. And that's why I like to focus on Episcopalians during these presentations when I'm speaking to Episcopalians like me, right? Because you all are members of my church. I'm a member of your church. We share this faith together, right? And in recent weeks, like really, really just since Easter, since Holy Week, the Episcopal Church has begun just slightly to be a little bit more pointed in how we talk about what's happening in Gaza right now. But the Episcopal Church has really been silent in some very hurtful ways throughout these past months. But it's not just these past months. In fact, I remember my first, the first time I ever went to General Convention was 2012. My son was a year old at the time. And remember that Cairo Palestine document I was telling you about, right? About where the patriarchs tell their story about being Palestinian Christians. So in the General Convention of 2012, there was a resolution this was the language of the resolution. It was really this like toothless. The resolution was to encourage Episcopal churches to study the Kairos Palestine document. There was a resolution on the floor to encourage Episcopal churches to study the Kairos Palestine document in 2012. It failed. You know why it failed? Because the many of the deputies, bishops and deputies, were worried that it might be offensive or hurtful to our Jewish siblings if Episcopal churches studied the Kairos Palestine document. 2012, right? That was the first time I felt truly betrayed by my church. But it has happened many, many, many times since, right? Now, are there other Christian denominations that are worse than the Episcopalians on this issue? Yes. There are many other Protestant Christian denominations that are worse on this issue. I think Christian Zionism is really embedded in the system and beliefs of Episcopalians, but it's not explicitly so. It is very much implicit, and we have to do some work to sort of dig that out and get over it, but it's not explicit, it's implicit. There are Christian churches out there who are explicitly Christian Zionist in every way, shape, and form, and are doing some really terrible things and saying some really terrible things in their support of Israel, right? So there are churches worse than the Episcopal Church out there. Are there churches better than the Episcopal Church out there? Yes. There are many denominations that are doing a better job than we Episcopalians are. So the UCC Church has named Israel's oppression of Palestinian people a sin. The Presbyterians, as I said, have developed this. They've been on board with the Kairos Palestine document for ages. They developed a whole study on it. The Lutheran bishop said in a statement at the very end of October, she condemned the actions of Israel as well as the actions of Hamas. She made them equitable, right? She used the language of condemnation for both. And you saw earlier in the quiz that even the Pope called Israel's treatment of Palestinians terrorism. The Pope used that word, right? That it was terrorism. We haven't had anything so strong in the Episcopal Church throughout, I mean, still to this day. There is some slow change. It is slow change. It's always slow change. But there is some slow change happening in the Episcopal Church. As Mona mentioned, I am one of the founding members of Palestinian Anglicans and Clergy Allies. You can find our website. The Executive Council of the Episcopal Church on April 20th put forth a resolution that quotes from the current patriarchs and churches for Middle East peace, and uses some more pointed language to talk about the actions of Israel. So there is a little bit of movement in the water, but it's interesting to me that the sort of murder, the height of murder and destruction that Israel is acting upon innocent civilians in Gaza has really had to be turned up so high in order for the Episcopal Church to begin to recognize and name that for what it is. So I said it was gonna get better, and it did get better, but then it got worse again. So sorry about that. But that is the end of our quiz. I think most of you did okay. I don't think, I think you still have a shot at heaven by the end of this. But we have just a few minutes. Are there any questions? Yes. Oh, sure. Well, that's okay. We don't have to. It's all right. We're good. Thank you. You want to go to the microphone? You have a question?
Sure.
Just so that people on Zoom can hear you.
So as a future clergy person in the Episcopal Church, how, and for other people in the Episcopal Church, how do we act as good allies to both Palestinians and Jewish people together?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me separate it for a minute and then come back to answering it together. You can be a good ally for Palestinians by doing a little research to start, right? Look up the Kairos-Palestine document. Try to prioritize the Palestinian voice, because the truth is that up until this point, what we hear in the media, what we hear through the church, is really the Jewish voice. That has been prioritized throughout many, many, many decades. So I'm not asking you to stop listening to the Jewish voice. I'm just asking you to give equal weight, at least equal weight, to the Palestinian voice, right? So there's social media accounts, there's all sorts of ways that you can look for and listen to the Palestinian voice. That's the first step, right? And I think within the Episcopal Church, we can then advocate for Palestinians who are actually members of our church, right? Both here in the States and in the Holy Land, right? So I think making sure that we're not the only ones that are listening to the Palestinian voice, but that we are making space in the church to hear the voice of Palestinians, both in the Episcopal Church and in the Anglican Communion at large. Talk to your bishop. The bishop is coming next Sunday, right? The bishop is here next Sunday. Please tell her. Have you talked to any Palestinians lately? You know, what Palestinian voices are you following? What Palestinians are you hearing from? Have you read the Kairos-Palestine document, Bishop? She's gonna get really mad at me, you know, if all you people start telling her, have you read the Kairos-Palestine document? But, you know, I make bishops mad. That's just what I do sometimes. So I think really prioritize the Palestinian Christian voice. How do you do that while continuing to be an ally for Jews? That's a really good question. And it's a really hard one, not because I don't think it's possible, but because the loudest voice that we have for Judaism in this country is a Zionist voice for Judaism. So whenever you say, I'm going to listen to Palestinian voices, you are going to be called anti-Semitic. I mean, I wish it was something different, but it's not. That is the reality in which we live. So I think what's really important is to continue to listen to Jewish voices too, but to refuse to say that anyone who says that that in order to be a good ally to them, you have to not be an ally to someone else is in the wrong, right? So anyone who tells you you can only be a good ally to Jews if you ignore Palestinians, that's just sinful. That's just wrong. So I think you have to navigate that and recognize that we can still be good allies for our Jewish siblings, but not at the cost of silencing our Palestinian ones. Okay? Yeah, other questions? Niels?
I just want to share this one comment from the folks who are, we have about 14 people on Zoom. One person said, amazing lecture, a Pentecostal moment. I understand what she is saying.
Oh, bless. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Yeah.
I apologize. I got here a little late, so I don't know if you said anything, but I'm just curious about how you feel about the students and the protests and how that feels for you.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, that's a great question. I am so proud of our students. I mean, I am so proud of our students. I think it takes a lot of courage to protest in whatever way, shape, or form. And I salute them and I encourage them because it's really, really risky. So I appreciate that. We also hear about some violence in those protests. And clearly that's never a good thing. What I find interesting is that Whenever we hear reports in the media about violent protesters, it's always the Palestinian protesters. It's all the always the pro-Palestinian protesters. But if you are keying in to the undercurrents, the ones, the reports that don't get publicized in the media, there have been way more anti-Palestinian violence. So I think it was at UT that some anti, you know, some like, what do you call the people who, thank you. The counter protesters came to the encampment at UT and were saying, it's the second Nakba. We're gonna enforce the second Nakba, right? The Nakba being the creation of Israel, where all the catastrophe, where all the Palestinians were evicted. But we don't hear that in national media, right? We don't hear those elements of racism and violence. The only ones we ever hear about are about the pro-Palestinian ones. And those are actually really minor, and there haven't been that many. But we don't hear about the counter-protesters and the violence and the racism that is involved in that. Yeah.
Talk about Hamas.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know much about Hamas. I know that Hamas was democratically elected, gosh, decades ago now, and then they just held on to their power. Are they a terrorist organization? Yeah, is what they did on October 7th horrific and terrorist? Yes, as is what Israel has been doing to Gaza and to the innocent people and innocent civilians in Palestine. So, I mean, what do we say about such folks? What do we say about them? We say that that is a corruption of God's goodwill for humanity. And what else can you say about it? Anything else? Yeah.
Can you give us your take on what it means to say from the sea to the river?
From the river to the sea. Yeah. So the phrase from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, right? I personally don't use that phrase, not because I don't believe it or not because I don't want it, but because it is so rhetorically charged right now. And because I have no control over what people think I mean when I say that phrase. So when I say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, does that mean that I want Israel exterminated? No, I already told you, I think Israel is here to stay, right? That doesn't make it okay what Israel did or what Israel is doing, but Israel is here to stay. What I mean when I say that phrase, which I don't publicly, but if I were to say that phrase, what I mean is that Palestinians should be free. Palestinians should have the right to live their lives, to flourish in the world on the land that is theirs, that belongs to them, right? That they should have all the rights, all the freedom, all the human dignity that every other race and people have throughout the world, right? Which is, if you think about it, all that that phrase is saying, from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free, right? It's just a hope. It's a hope that exists in a place where Palestinians are not allowed to be free. No Palestinian in the Holy Land right now lives a free life. They are persecuted. They are violated. They are murdered. They are killed over and over and over again. They are starved to death. Their children are starved to death, right? They are not allowed to live a free life as they should be, as we all should be. Are we out of time, Mona? We're out of time. Thank you all very much. This was lovely. Really appreciate it.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.